Blog Talk Radio.
Talking Law.
Talking Law.
Talking Law.
Talking Law with Dan Hochheiser.
You can't handle the truth.
Talking Law with Dan Hochheiser analyzes criminal cases in the news, trends in the law, and covers all legal current events.
Overruled.
Our host, criminal defense attorney in New York, Daniel Hochheiser. Each week, Talking Law with Dan Hochheiser features newsmakers, attorneys, media personalities, celebrities, politicians, business people, and so much more.
Straight talk, no nonsense.
Here's Talking Law with your host, Dan Hochheiser.
June 3rd, 2015. Good morning, Talking Law fans. This is your host, Dan Hochheiser, attorney in New York, broadcasting to you live from Lower Manhattan, just east of the Freedom Tower. I hope everybody's doing well today. We are going to have a great show for you today. We will interview a great guest. We will have Beth Karras, of course. We will do the question of the day. But I want to remind everybody first that you can follow me on Twitter at Dan Hochheiser, H-O-C-H-H-E-I-S-E-R. You can like our Facebook page to get all the latest updates on the show, facebook.com/talkinlaw. And you can listen to all our prior podcasts on blogtalkradio.com/talkinlaw. Remember, no G in talking. And you could also get our show on iTunes. So please like our Facebook page, facebook.com/talkinlaw, or if you like, you could send me an email at talkinlaw@gmail.com. No G in talking. Talkinlaw@gmail.com. I would love to hear from you. Last week's show was terrific. We had former Congressman Bob Ney on the program, who broke down the Republican race for the presidency for us. If you're interested in politics, that's a must-listen to show. Go to blogtalkradio.com and check it out, blogtalkradio.com/talkinlaw. So what are we going to do today specifically? We are going to do the question of the day about law and comedy. We are going to interview Alex Barnett, who was a lawyer and now is a comedian. Very interesting man. And after Alex, we will answer the question of the day, and then we will go to Beth Karras for an update on the Colorado theater shooting trial, where James Holmes is being tried for massacring people in a Colorado movie theater. And we will also try to get to a discussion about the Southern Poverty Law Center's latest lawsuit against a conversion therapy provider that is trying to treat people who are homosexual, who, according to the defendants, want to live a heterosexual life. So that's the Michael Ferguson versus Jonah case, and we'll speak to Beth about that as well. So let us ask the question of the day. Question: are there other professional comedians besides our guest Alex Barnett who began as lawyers before crossing over to comedy? Alex Barnett, our guest today, graduated from St. John's University School of Law and became an attorney. He was laid off from a small Washington, D.C. law firm in 2008 and then started performing at comedy clubs for the money. To get an idea of the kind of work Alex has been doing, take a listen.
No, we are. We're a multiracial family, and it presents challenges. Just so you know, my wife, dark, big afro. I'm less dark, no afro. The baby's kind of in the middle between dark and light, kind of gray. And people always come up to us, what race is it? I'm like, I don't know, master race. Because the Germans aren't using the title anymore. I mean, what kind of silly question is that? You're looking right at us. There's only three choices. Chocolate, vanilla, cafe au lait. And it's offensive because people would never ask us in any other context. You'd never go up to a couple where one's fat and one's thin, saying like, so what's it gonna be? Like diabetes, a little chubby, just kind of ready. Where they'll go up to my wife when she's by herself with the baby, and they'll say, is he yours? Yeah, because they think she's the nanny, right? Which is unbelievably wrong. Well, it's very flattering. They think I have enough money to afford it. But it's wrong. So my wife got up. She's upset. She's like, what do I do? I'm like, okay, here's what you do next time it happens. Is he mine? Yes, I found him on a bus right in the middle.
Alex Barnett, are you with me?
Yes, I am. Thanks for having me.
How are you, Alex?
I'm good. I'm great. Thank you very much again for having me on the show. I appreciate it.
I've listened to some of your stuff on the internet, and your material is really excellent. I commend you for doing such good and funny work. And you're not only funny, but you know, your background as a lawyer is obviously one of the things that you know, made me want to have you on the podcast. And you know, not only were you a lawyer and now you're a comedian, but you're also a fellow podcast host. You host the Multiracial Family Man podcast. So I really want to get into all these issues with you. But as you do on your show with your guests, I'd like to start from before the beginning. You know,
okay.
Tell our listeners a little bit about, you know, how you grew up, the environment you grew up in, your parents, et cetera.
Sure. Well, I think, like almost everybody in the known universe, I was originally from Brooklyn, and my whole family's from there. All four of my grandparents, actually, born and raised in Brooklyn, and I was born there, but I was quickly exiled to Long Island as part of, I guess, everyone's American dream. And that's where I grew up, in Long Island in Nassau County, in Roslyn Heights in Mineola. Went to Wheatley High School, if anybody from Wheatley's listening to this. And my dad is a lawyer, was a lawyer. He's retired now.
What kind of law did dad do?
Well, he did a mixture of things. Originally, he started out with, you know, in your field, he was a criminal lawyer. He worked at the Department of Justice under Robert Kennedy. And then he worked in the U.S. Attorney's Office in the Eastern District. And then he switched into civil litigation, working for a sort of arts and entertainment firm that no longer exists, actually. And then he briefly took a detour. He left the law entirely and worked in a family business that didn't make it, unfortunately, because that would have been my key to riches. And so he went back into practicing, I guess, around age 40, 45, and, you know, cobbled together a career again, working at a variety of different firms, mostly doing sort of real estate-based transactional and litigation work. And ultimately working for himself at the end of his career until he retired. So he had sort of a various different iterations. And my mom is an artist, was a social worker and a trained art therapist, but really was an artist and still paints and does collage and a variety of different things. So
we have a couple of things in common. We're both Jews, but we also both have fathers who are lawyers. So I know how I wound up in law school, but tell our listeners how you wound up in law school. What caused you to want to go? Was this just following in the father's footsteps kind of thing, or was there some other motivation?
Yeah, I wish I could say that, oh, you know, when I was three, I always knew I wanted to be a lawyer from watching Ironside or something like that, or reruns of it. But really, I think for me, like for so many people who wind up in law school, it was sort of the thing of getting to the end of college and not really knowing what was next and what else to do. And my dad, who's a lawyer, had friends who had were in bigger firms, and one in particular was a partner at, and still is, I guess, technically a partner at Wachtell Lipton. And I wound up working there in the summer as a summer paralegal and kind of liked it and went back the following summer. And then when I graduated from college, I figured I'd work there until I sort of figured out what I wanted to do. But in the meantime, I took the LSAT and did relatively well and just thought, well, you know, I like this and this is kind of cool. And I did well in the LSAT, so that probably means something. And so I wound up applying to law school more or less just kind of out of momentum, not really necessarily because I knew exactly that's what I wanted to do with my life.
You know, and I get, I don't know about you, but I get a lot, you know, I've been practicing law for 18 years now. And, you know, a lot of people ask me, friends who have kids or young people who are in college, you know, should I go to law school? Should I not? And I'm really very apprehensive about advising somebody to go to law school unless they really think they want to be a lawyer and practice law. You know, it used to be that people thought, well, law school is great for everything, business and everything else. But I'm really not sure that's the case at this stage of the game when the industry is so saturated with lawyers and, you know, there are too many lawyers waiting tables. I don't know what your views are on that issue.
Yeah, I think I share that view. I think when I went to law school, which sounds like right about the same time as you, maybe a couple years earlier, you know, I finished in 92. But when I was entering, law was still very much considered sort of a craft. It was coming out of that era of, you know, people were craftsmen as lawyers. They were considered practitioners. It wasn't so much a job as a profession. I think almost the old, harkening back to the old days of craftsmen and apprentices, things were done at a slightly slower pace. You know, there was no such thing when I went to law school. Or it was just starting Lexis and Westlaw, so it was still very much book-driven. Lawyers would handwrite their briefs and hand them to secretaries who would then type them on typewriters. I think it was just a sort of a smaller, slower-paced thing. And I think also what was true in the economy of those days was what you said, which is that people felt like law was a much more applicable background to have in all kinds of different pursuits, which to some degree is true still, but I think the world has become so specialized and so niche-oriented, and the practice of law has become so complicated and complex and so high-speed that I think your ultimate position is exactly right, which is that you shouldn't really go into law unless you really, really know you want to be a lawyer. And in fact, you probably don't have some sense of what kind of law you want to practice.
You're listening to Talkin' Law Radio with Dan Hochheiser. I'm speaking to lawyer-turned-comedian Alex Barnett, host of the Multiracial Family Man podcast. You can follow Alex Barnett on Twitter at Barnett Comic with two T's, Barnett Comic with two T's on Twitter. You can check out his website at www.alexbarnettcomic.com. AlexBarnettComic.com. Alex, you know, when you were talking about law school before Lexis and all that stuff, you know, it made me smile and think about shepherdizing cases through the actual books.
Yeah.
I apologize to the listeners, but do you remember that?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I remember it all. When I went to college, there was no, you know, people didn't have computers, and there was no such thing as email. And when we went to law school, I think it was like two computers in the whole school. And you're right, shepherdizing was done by hand. It was such an onerous process.
Oh, my God. In any event, I'm glad that I haven't had to shepherdize anything in 400 law books like we used to do for many, many years. And but we can smile about it. But let's talk about 2008. That was a big year in your life. You were laid off from your law firm job in D.C. What happened there?
Yeah, I worked for a small boutique class action firm that was a sort of spin-off of the bigger class action firm I had been at for a number of years. And I was a partner, junior partner there in my, you know, for a while, with anybody who has a contingent fee practice knows, money's always an issue. And for, I don't know, a year or so, I've been telling my partner, look, I think we need to sort of change the model and take on some paying clients or do some different things. And he didn't really want to listen. And then, sure enough, at the beginning of the year, he pulled me aside and said, look, you know, hey, money is tight, and the easiest way for me to cut down on our bottom line and save money is to get rid of you. Because I was in New York, and I was in D.C. where the main office was. So that's what he said. He said, look, you know, the quickest way for me to change things financially is to let you go. And he was the majority partner, so I really had no control over it, and that's what he did. You know, I think it was regrettable in a lot of ways, because I think a lot of the things I had been suggesting he's since implemented as changes to the practice, but in a way it was, you know, the whole cliche of a door closes, a window opens, or another door opens, and that's kind of what happened for me.
So what was the first time, and you can back, you know, go back to as far back as you need to answer this question, but when was the first time you realized that you were funny?
Oh, well, I mean, I think, you know, like probably a lot of people, I had sort of water cooler funny, you know, from an early age where I could make people laugh just by telling a funny story. But I don't know that I knew I could do it, you know, again and again with frequency, really until I started performing. You know,
when was the first time you performed?
Yeah, it was back in, it was actually when I was still at the firm. I had done sort of as a lark, I had taken some acting classes and I was writing. My goal was to write. I wanted to write a novel, and I'd written this, at least the first draft of a novel, and I started taking acting classes because I sort of had opened up the creative side of my brain and took a stand-up comedy class, just again, really sort of as a lark, and I really enjoyed it. And that was the first time where I wrote something down and performed it. I was able to repeat the process and make people laugh twice at the same thing.
Do you remember the first joke you wrote that worked?
Oh boy. Honestly, no.
Okay. It was worth a shot.
Yeah. I wish I could say that I did, but I really don't. And I'm sure whatever it was terrible.
So. well, now you're really good. So, you have to be, terrible before you get really good, I guess. So, you lost this job at the law firm because of the financial situation with that senior partner, and then you just started to dive into comedy full time. Did you know right then, well, I'm going to go be a comedian, or did you first try to get another job? What happened?
No, it was really a low point of my life, to be brutally honest. It was really bad. I was already 40. I was almost 41. I had no job. I was been a plaintiff's lawyer for a long time, so I had no, you know, billable clients or portfolio of business that I could bring with me anywhere. And I was really panic stricken, and I spent months looking for a job. And I actually
a law job?
Yes. I hadn't been thinking about comedy at all. I was just desperate to find a job that paid a relatively decent salary. And I scrambled around. I looked in different cities, even, and I ultimately did get a job offer for a decent job back in D.C., which I had certain misgivings about, and ultimately I just couldn't see doing it. And when I turned that down, that's when I said, you know what, maybe I just need to step away from all of this for a while and do something completely different. And because I had been writing and performing, I thought, you know what, let me do that, because if I do it and I succeed, great. And if I don't, at least I can say I did it, and I won't look back when I'm 60 or 70 and say, you know what, I regret that I didn't do it.
And so that's started in comedy at 41?
Well, no, I had already dabbled for like a year or so. But yeah, I mean, basically the main thrust of my professional comedy career started at age 41.
Wow, that's really something. And and when did you get married?
We got married shortly thereafter. So it was, I guess, 2011, yeah.
Okay, and tell us about your family. Of course, I'm leading into the podcast that you host. Tell us about your interesting family.
Sure. Well, my wife is a black woman, African-American versus, I guess, West Indian, which is a very large segment in New York of West Indians. But she's black from Detroit originally, and she has converted to Judaism, so that we're comprehensively, I guess, Jewish family. And we have a young son who's almost 4 now, who's biracial. And that family unit and that construction is really sort of the crux of my work, my artistic work, whether it's the podcast or my, you know, onstage work or even my writing that I do. Talking about multiracial families and multiracial Jewish families.
And I want to say that in preparation for the show, I listened to your interview. And forgive me, but I forget her name. It was an Asian woman who's married to a Caucasian guy. And then I listened briefly to the last show where you interviewed, I believe, a woman from Jamaica, a black woman from Jamaica, who's a journalist.
Yeah, so that was, she listened to the last two episodes, which was Grace Wang Lynch, who is a Taiwanese-American, first-generation Taiwanese-American, very interesting woman. She's a sort of a journalist and mommy blogger. And the last person was Stacey Ann Gooden, who sort of like a local celebrity. She does the weather. She's the weather anchor on TV12 here in New York, on reporting on the weather in the Bronx and Brooklyn. And she actually herself is a first generation American. I mean, she moved from Jamaica to America when she was a child. And she's a very interesting woman. So yeah, those were two really good interviews, I thought, in terms of.
So, as did I. And it's funny because I'm a white Jewish guy. I'm married to a white Jewish woman, but I identified with your podcast, and I'll tell you why. I grew up, I don't know how you grew up, but I grew up in a sort of a secular, reform, not very observant Jewish home in Westchester County in New York. And in law school, I met a woman from Miami Beach who came from an Orthodox Jewish family. So we got married, and I really think of us as like, it's not an interracial marriage, but it's an interculture marriage. I mean, it's really two different worlds colliding, and I really did identify with the kinds of issues that you talk about.
Yeah, well, I mean, those distinctions that you're talking about can be just as stark and profound as racial differences. In fact, often racial differences are not very, marked day to day, and so cultural or racial or religious ones can be much more impactful on a family. So I'm sure that you guys have dealt with things that are far bigger day to day, or in terms of navigating how what you're doing with kids or what have you, than say my wife and I would do in terms of how are we going to dress when we go out of the house, or how are we going to whatever. But yeah, I grew up in a house that was sort of split. My mom came from a religious background. My dad, his family is sort of very assimilationist. So there was always this conflict when I was a kid about how observant we really were.
Well, I tell you, my wife wasn't too pleased on our second date. We're at a diner, and I took a bite into a ham and cheese omelet. That really didn't go over that good. But yeah. I got through it, and I'm married 18 years, so I guess it's working.
Well, there you go, Mazel Tov.
thank you.
Yeah, 18 is a big year for you guys, right?
Man. So now I am blessed, and have three great kids. Let's talk about, in terms of being prepared for your life in comedy, did being a lawyer help you with that? Did the writing in the law help you with comedic writing? Are they too different for that to have any use, or how is that?
No, it's an excellent question. It's one that people have asked frequently, because I think people see like trial lawyers on TV and they think, well, this must, overlap. And the answer is there is some benefit in both directions. I mean, it's not complete, but there is some benefit. I mean, I think the one thing that law gives you that helps in comedy is the ability to write things down and go back and edit them and think through the logic train from A to B to C to D to the end. I think that's something that law teaches you that becomes very useful for comedy. Where it kind of stops is that the comedy, I mean, brevity really is the soul of wit. You really have to, contrary to this answer, you really have to be very terse. And law, I think we tend to repeat ourselves and introduce a concept, say the concept, and then conclude with a repetition of what the concept was. Where in comedy, it's sort of like you say what you have to say and get out. So
let me ask you this, Alex. I don't know, I graduated law school in 96, so you, I think, were 4 years before I was, but basically around the same time. In law school, I remember we were taught the IRAC method. Frame the issue, you state the rule, you apply the law to the facts, and then you state your conclusion. And that's really how we were taught to write and how to take the bar exam. But is there a similar formula for comedic writing?
No, it's an art, so it's not subject to such rigid formulas. I mean, I think knowing how to do that helps you when you analyze a joke or why it's not working. But I think the best jokes are ones where literally something happens, or you think of something, and the kernel of truth that makes it funny just comes to you sort of organically. Now, what happens often is that maybe you have something that's 75% finished and you need help kind of polishing it, and that's where sort of legal writing in terms of logic and knowing words helps you kind of edit it down. But I don't think you can apply like an IRAC method to comedy writing.
Right. Go ahead, Alex. I apologize.
Well, I was going to say, part of your question was, does it help in reverse? And I did want to make that point, which is that I think that performing comedy definitely made me a better legal writer. It definitely helped me get to the point faster. Again, not in this answer, but, in life.
That's okay. We have time. We have a couple minutes left. So tell us what you're working on now, where you're going to be performing and you know, what's the next big thing for Alex Barnett?
Sure, sure. I appreciate that. Well, so as you mentioned, I have this multiracial family man blog, which has really become sort of the centerpiece of my efforts these days. I put a lot of time and energy into it, as I know you put into this podcast. And then secondarily, you know, people could see me performing live at Gotham Comedy Club basically every weekend. I'm there every Saturday night, a couple Fridays every month. And that's, you know, I've tried to kind of cut down my road work only because having a kid at home, I don't want to be away from home. So that's kind of the limits of what I'm doing stand-up-wise, where people would want to come see me. And then, I write on my own blog, and I write for various magazines and webzines, like the Good Men Project, which is really sort of dedicated to fatherhood and men and raising kids. And then, you know, separately, I've got a book in the works that I've been polishing for a little while, and then working on a TV project with a bud of mine. So those are a couple things I'm doing. But in terms of just week in, week out, frequent content, if people really want to hear what I'm up to, I guess the podcast is probably the best bet if they don't want to leave their houses.
Fantastic. And what advice would you give a lawyer? There are a lot, you know, some lawyers who are unhappy with the law, and they think that they're stuck in the law and they can't make a transition. What would you say to somebody who's, you know, say you were 41 years old and they want to make a career change?
Yeah, well, I think, listen, at the end of the day, if you're really unhappy, then you should definitely change, because life is short, and as far as we know, you only get one of them, unless the Buddhists are absolutely right. But that, having said that, I think it means, you know, doing some homework and thinking really about what it is you want to do and recognizing that there may be difficulties and obstacles along the way, that, you know, being an entrepreneur isn't just open up a store and make $1 zillion, so that, you know, you should take your time and do it properly. The other thing that people forget is, you know, things don't have to be absolute. I mean, I didn't give up my law license. I still practice law, which I talk about a lot, you know, on stage, but, you know, I need... Money is a real thing in this world. You need money. And I think people, you know, 100, 200 years ago used to have different hats. And I think people should recognize that it's okay to be, you know, a teacher and a painter and a golfer. And you can be a lawyer and a this and a that. And they don't have to be mutually exclusive.
Alex Barnett, you are a Renaissance man, lawyer, comedian, podcast host, father, husband. Thank you so much. I really enjoyed this. I'd like to come see you sometime at Gotham. That would be fun. And I encourage everybody to check out the Multiracial Family Podcast. It's really good. Alex, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Take care. Now, the answer to the question of the day, are there other professional comedians besides our guest, Alex Barnett, who began as lawyers before crossing over to comedy? Answer. In addition to the 7 lawyer-turned-comedians associated with the website comediansatlaw.com, there was the late Greg Giraldo, who unfortunately passed, but he graduated from Harvard Law and practiced briefly at Skadden before becoming a very successful stand-up comedian. Mike Sweeney is another lawyer-turned-comedian who is a Fordham Law School graduate. And Al Lubell is a very successful comedian who practiced law briefly in California before turning to comedy full-time. Now, this is not comedy. This is no joke. Give me Beth. Give me Kiss.
Beth, what can I do?
Talkin' Law Radio brings you a live Karras on Crime special report from Beth Karras, former prosecutor, Court TV, HLN television correspondent, and founder of KarrasOnCrime.com. Now here's Beth with the latest legal news.
Beth, what can I do?
Hey, Beth.
Good morning.
How are you?
I'm fine. Chugging along.
Good. And, we have some new information about the internal workings of the mind of James Holmes in the Colorado Theater shooting trial, I hear.
Yes, indeed. Since we last spoke a week ago, one of the many forensic psychiatrists expected to take the stand in this 3 to 4 month trial, took the stand last Thursday. He evaluated homes in July and August of 2014, 2 years after the shooting. He was court appointed. He was the second of two court appointed psychiatrists. And he videotaped his whole evaluation, which I find so fascinating, instead of having a psychiatrist on the stand saying, and then when I asked him about this, he said this, and this is my take on it, blah, blah, blah. You know, it's interesting. You're hearing the whole evaluation, the whole Q&A. The DA is playing part of it and then questioning the doctor about some things to clarify and then playing another few hours. So the jurors started to see the video last Thursday afternoon, and there's 22 hours. So today they're about to start, you know, be the fifth day of the video. It's going to go through this week, and then he'll be cross-examined. Anyway, the bottom line is we're getting inside his mind, and we don't in these mass killers most of the time, right, because they die at the scene at their own hand or the hand of a police officer, but usually their own hand. And we've seen the notebook, and now, you know, we get to see him answering these questions, putting the sentences together, explaining why he did what he did, answering some questions about the notebook, although when the doctor said, well, why did you write all those pages of why, and he kind of smirked and said, don't ask me why, and that was his answer.
In terms of you said there were 22 hours of video?
Yes.
How much has been presented in court so far?
Well, today's the fifth day. You know, it's hard to judge. I don't know if in maybe 9 or 10, because there's questioning also. So it's not a full day of video because they'll break it up. The DA breaks it up and questions him, questions the doctor with follow-up questions to explain certain things that happen. It's really
fascinating.
So give us the
highlights about what we're learning above and beyond what we learned from his notebook diary entries.
So he said that he was basically transferring his suicidal thoughts to homicidal thoughts by planning the killing, that he chose a midnight showing because he didn't want to kill children. He didn't pick Batman on purpose. He claims there's no correlation, although the inmates in the jail call him the Joker. And his intention was to kill at least three people. He was not specifying anyone in particular, although he later admitted that he did point at two people intentionally. Everyone else was just random. He was shooting kind of blindly because he said the mask and his eyes, it was like scratch. There were scratches on the visor, whatever he was looking through, so it was a little bit blurry for him. He first fired his shotgun. He remembers six shots. And then he took the rifle, which was an automatic. He only remembers the first three, but he must have shot a lot more than that. He emptied the magazine. He tried to put in another 30-round magazine, but there was one round in the chamber, and it was a full magazine. And you can't load it when there's a round in the chamber and a full magazine. The magazine can't be full, and he didn't know that, so it jammed. And then he used his handgun. So he describes the shooting. He remembers seeing someone being carried out that he had shot. He just figured when he stopped shooting it, you know, that he was done. I mean, he just finished. He learned later that he had killed 12, but he thought, well, I'm worth 12 more than that. He thought that his mission wouldn't be successful unless he killed at least three people. He figured he had killed four or five and maybe injured 20. Obviously, he kills 12, he injures 70. He said, oh, the 70, they're just collateral damage. He didn't really think about the effect on the families of the injury he was doing to people, the effect on the families left behind by those he killed. He really didn't think about that. He hated mankind. He thought he was dealing with the threats that he felt in the company of other people by killing people. He sent the notebook to the doctor knowing that it wouldn't be received before the shooting. I mean, he knew it was going to be received afterwards. He had no plans for a getaway. He figured he was going to die there. I question why all the body armor if he figured he was going to die there. Or he was going to be arrested and he would die in prison. So he had absolutely no plans. I mean, so that's some of the highlights. But every day there's something coming out. It's pretty fascinating.
So they're going to finish up the rest of these lengthy videotaped interviews with the psychiatrist. And then Do we know what the prosecution is going to present after the video?
You know, we don't, because they don't tip their hand, you know, in advance. Nor is there a witness list. It is still sealed. But it's interesting to me that the state started with the second court-appointed doctor, and not the first, who evaluated him earlier. He didn't assert the insanity defense right away, and, you know, these court-appointed doctors don't get appointed until the insanity defense was asserted. But maybe because this doctor, whose name is William Reed, videotaped it, and it's pretty powerful to see, you know, the cameras on Holmes, and, you know, you're just, and it's pretty good when you're in the courtroom. The audio is not so great listening online, but it might be just more impactful to begin with him. So I assume that the state is still going to call the second court-appointed psychiatrist who evaluated him first, because the DA referred to both of them in his opening statement. In addition, they have psychiatrist Michael Wellner and Philip Resnick. They have mentioned. Now, I am assuming, and I've seen both of these doctors in trials, and Wellner's a New York-based psychiatrist. I am assuming that both of them didn't evaluate Holmes, because I don't think the state gets access to a defendant. They're using the court-appointed doctors, but that they'll do some sort of assessment based on all of the documentation and watching the video.
You're listening to Talkin' Law Radio with Dan Hochheiser. I'm speaking with Beth Karas of KarasOnCrime.com about the Colorado Theater shooting trial, which is underway with videotaped evidence of interviews by psychiatrists of the defendant, James Holmes, ongoing. Beth, is there any projection among those in the know about when the prosecution's case may be complete?
Yes. This is week 6 in the case, and the prosecution had told the judge they thought they needed 8 weeks, and the judge is really holding them to that. He said, you know, you really should be able to finish this case in 8 weeks. They front-loaded it with a lot of the survivors and, you know, obviously law enforcement. So I'm assuming this second half in the next few weeks will be all the psychiatric testimony. I don't know if they'll keep to the schedule, but the judge said, you know, I'm holding you to that. So I think that there's maybe 2.5 or 3 weeks left of their case.
So let's switch gears a little bit to this civil lawsuit, which you actually told me about, and I checked it out, and it's fascinating. It's the Southern Poverty Law Center, which is representing, I believe, 3 or 4 plaintiffs in the case captioned Michael Ferguson versus Jonah. This is a New Jersey consumer fraud lawsuit against this organization, Jonah, and they're being sued for deceptive practices for luring homosexual plaintiffs into a program of therapy. Give us sort of a summary of what the issues are in the lawsuit and what's the status of the case.
Yes, these three young men, gay men, all were 17, 18, they're young, and two mothers of two of them are the plaintiffs, so there's 5 plaintiffs. And the men engaged in this conversion therapy, this organization claiming that they could change them from gay to straight, something that is really poo-pooed in the medical profession, the psychiatric profession. I mean, decades ago, they said, you know, homosexuality is not a mental disorder, and, you know, the roots of it, is it hormonal, is it genetic, whatever, is still somewhat a mystery, but nonetheless, they're saying it's not a disorder. Yet this organization says, look, you know, we can make you straight. And it can be painful things that an individual goes through. But they say we only do this for people who want it. If they're unhappy being gay, we'll make them basically happy. So these young men claim one did it for 4 months, one did it for 1.5 years. It didn't work. They said it didn't work. It costs, you know, one of the plaintiff's mothers over $10,000 a year or something. I mean, it's costly. It's New Jersey-based, by the way. And they said it doesn't work. So it was fraudulent, deceptive practices. They're claiming it works and it doesn't work. That's sort of the basis of it. But the Southern Poverty Law Center being involved says, look, you know, this is really, you know, this is unfair. This is not something that, you know, you should be doing to individuals and basically luring them to change their orientation. It is what it is. So, you know, we'll see. The trial started this week. I was just waiting to get word if openings are today or evidence is today, because it depended on how long jury selection lasted, which was supposed to start yesterday.
And I saw some video on the internet where the defense attorney for Jonah was interviewed. And my understanding of his argument in defense of his client is that, you know, my client said that there were no guarantees that the treatment would work. And these plaintiffs are people who came to us for help, and they wanted to change their behavior, and we tried to help them change their behavior so they could live a life they told us they wanted to live. They said they want to live a heterosexual life, and they wanted to fight their, I guess, homosexual tendencies. And they said, you know, the lawyer says, what's wrong with that? Why can't we try to help these people live the life they want? That's my understanding of the argument.
Right, that's right. But I think what's happening here is that it's young people, a lot are young people, so are they really consenting, or are their parents pressuring them to do it? That is an issue, too, because, you know, at least one of them was 17 years old at the time, and the parents were pushing them to do it. So
right.
when they're teenagers and still, you know, kind of conflicted and not understanding and feeling a lot of societal pressures, perhaps to be, you know, more masculine or whatever. So I don't know how it's going to shake out. Maybe, you know, the defense will fail only because, as you say, there are no guarantees, and we take people voluntarily. We're not.
Yeah, well, and it seems to me, I mean, the real controversy here is bigger than the lawsuit, I think. It's the whole issue of, you know, are people born homosexual, period, which I think, you know, is supported by, you know, the majority opinion and the majority of psychiatric scientific thought. But there are those like the defendants, Jonah, and their lawyers who say, no, it's not all nature. There is a component of environment and behavior and values and this kind of thing. So I don't think this lawsuit is going to be the end of this issue.
Oh, no. And they do claim that that homosexuality is rooted, at least in large part, in not having a strong relationship with a father figure, which, you know, I think maybe in the case of some, there isn't a strong male figure in the family, but I have gay friends who have, you know, wonderful fathers and good relationships with their fathers, so I don't know where that comes from. In any event, Jonah claims that they have, you know, like the vast majority of their participants in the program have been successful, and I say that quote-unquote successful. But it's very painful when you read the things that they make them do, you know, like go to bathhouses naked with older men, so they're like around father figures, so they're, you know, not be attracted, and standing in the room naked, an effigy to their mother, beating an effigy to their mother. I mean, I don't understand. So,
Beth, I think beating an effigy to your mother is a great way to end the show.
Oh, no.
Beth, I wanted to ask you about Casey Anthony. Did you hear about this?
Well, I know she was in town for an interview, but I just kind of tuned it out because I thought, who's going to pay her for an interview? What happened?
Right. Well, I think she went to NBC for talks about a possible interview or a movie or something. Anyway, maybe we'll get into it next week. Beth Karras, KarrasOnCrime.com. Thanks as always, Beth.
My pleasure. Bye-bye.
Take care. I want to say thank you to Alex Barnett, a very funny man. Go check him out at the Gotham Comedy Club in New York at alexbarnett.comic.com, alexbarnett.comic.com, two T's. Check out Beth Karras' website, KarrasOnCrime.com. It's worth the $5 a month. Thank you, Mark Goldman, my producer, who always does such a great job. Next Wednesday, we'll have another great show for you at 9:30 a.m. Between now and then, I want to wish everybody peace and justice. And don't forget to like our Facebook page, facebook.com/talkinglaw. No G in talking. Follow me on Twitter, @DanHochheiser, HochheiserHeiser.